I'm Brian Roth, and you're listening to the Good Beer Hunting Podcast. Welcome back for another episode of the Good Beer Hunting Collective, where we bring you stories behind the stories from our writers and photographers located all over the world. This series of episodes is made possible by our Patreon subscribers. Patreon is a way that our readers and listeners can subscribe to GBH with a monthly contribution, just like subscribing to a magazine. We give back to our subscribers, known as our fervent few, through events, discounts, exclusive gear and art, and a host of other perks. Because to us, being a fervent few member makes you part of the team, and that shows every day as subscribers interact directly with the GBH crew through a special Slack channel set up as a two-way form of communication to share thoughts, ideas, and discuss the latest stories. If you want to join, visit patreon.com, that's patreon.com/goodbeerhunting, or click on the link in our show notes. For this latest version of the GBH Collective, we've got Good Beer Hunting's trio of podcast hosts together on the mic for the first time. Join me, Matthew Curtis, and Michael Kaiser as we found time to chat during our time in Denver during the Great American Beer Festival. We discussed the North American Guild of Beer Writers Awards, the value of GABF, and some of the things that make good beer hunting tick. This is the GBH Collective. Listen in.
Jesus. Okay.
All three hosts for the first time together.
It's really nice to have you guys on the couch. Thanks so much for joining.
It's nice to be on the couch.
Yeah. So as we sit down, this is midway through the Great American Beer Festival here in Denver. Opportunity to just, I guess, kind of chat and see what's what and what we're working on and what we're thinking about at this particular moment in time. Matthew, I was one of the things that I actually thought about when I knew you were coming, because this isn't your first time at the festival.
No, it'd be my third.
But I want to be a completely ignorant American and ask in terms of kind of, you know, the festivals, the events that you experience in London and elsewhere, how that is different or how things might translate to what happens here.
That's a good question, because to be perfectly honest, there's nothing like GABF in the UK or anywhere else. I don't know of any other festival that not only is of this size and magnitude. I mean, how many people is there per session? 15,000?
Yeah.
I think you maybe get 5,000, so a third of that per session at the Great British Beer Festival. And even if you do get more of that, it's a very different atmosphere because people go in, they drink pints, there's no rush, there's no queuing. It's a very different environment. And then GABF to me feels frenetic, especially with the queuing, with people rushing to get to bars of, you know, other half of there this year, I believe, and I understand they had a huge queue yesterday. You know, we've just witnessed that in the UK at Beavertown, so I know what that can be like, but it's a very, very different experience. And the other interesting thing is, you know, you pay a high price. It's an $80 ticket, and some festivals, like the Beavertown Extravaganza, like the London Craft Beer Festival, have started pushing this all-inclusive ticket, but that's mostly an alien concept in the UK. People will buy a ticket and then pay for the beer once they go in. Because for the mainstream drinker, convincing them that they're not going to be able to get a pint it's alien to them. And to say, oh, you're going to have this much beer, I'm making the 1 ounce pour gesture.
That looks like two.
That's two? Well, that's being generous.
Yeah. Depends, you know, how far along in the night you are, really.
I know some friends from the UK who came and they said, oh yeah, we tried 140 beers. And I'm like, how did you get around that many brewers? And it was like sip, 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 just passing through. But for most people in the UK, the way GABF works is alien to the UK drinker.
Mm-hmm. It's quite literally the volume is what, say, an average person is thinking about.
Yeah.
Versus the ability to try something new or different.
Exactly.
Yeah. That. Yeah. The 1 ounce pour in terms of what that is and what it presents, especially the speed of which you can do it. What interests me with GABF is the change that you kind of see over the course of the few days, where I feel like Thursday, Friday, and then into the Saturday sessions, there seems to be a very deliberate change in how people are doing it. Mm. In terms of the quantity and perhaps the speed of which they're drinking?
Yes. I think people might come on Saturday to party.
Yeah.
The other thing that, that impresses me is the volume of breweries, because there's no festival that has, what, is there 800 brewers pouring? Mm-hmm. But, you know, there's... That kind of magnitude just doesn't exist in the UK. So it's, you know, I've just been in a bar with some friends from the UK who've come over deliberately to visit the festival. They've timed their visit for it because it is that kind of festival. It has that draw. Mm-hmm. So it's, yeah, it's, we just don't have anything like it back home.
Yeah. And I suppose the flip side of the excitement of the festival right now, from your perspective, Michael, so we also just had ceremony for the North American Guild of Beer Writers. Mm-hmm. Where Good Beer Hunting won, it was 6 awards, I believe.
Yeah,
yeah.
Yeah, well, our writers did. Yeah.
Yes, yes. So, as Papa Bear to Good Beer Hunting.
None of the people sitting here, though.
No.
No.
Some of our amazing, amazing team. Not us.
That's right. Yeah, that was pretty interesting. This is the first time I've been able to attend the actual award ceremony, which was interesting. And increasingly, these are the kinds of things that are becoming attractive for me around GABF time is, I think in the last 2 or 3 years I've come, actually last year I didn't come, the year before I came, and that was the first time I didn't go to the festival at all, never went in the building. I think I went to the award ceremony maybe at the very end, which I really enjoy. Mm. But increasingly, the festival itself is not the draw anymore. It's the fact that it has so much gravity and brings all these people to town that I sort of feel obligated to be here for a couple of days because so many things are happening with people that I've wanted to interact with. Clients are here. The guild wards are here. A lot of our writers end up being here. It becomes a real industry town for a few days, which is really exciting and fun. And I get to accomplish a lot in just a short amount of time.
Yeah, I think one of the things that I've run into in terms of just trying to reach out to people ahead of time that I may want to talk to or meet for the first time is I always preface it with, I know things are going to be very insane, yes. ... and so it's kind of like you have to, I think the perspective that you have and the way that you go about it is probably the most efficient way, I think. I still feel like you're just trying to chase somebody down, and then it's, you know, you might get 5 minutes unless it's kind of on the books
right.
Well ahead of time.
Yeah, yeah. No, there was the two main draws for me this year were Bavana, Brewery Bavana from back in Raleigh, North Carolina. A client of ours we just launched this year. They were distributing through True Brewing here, and they were doing a few events. They were going to be on draft around town, and their bottles were out, which we just finished designing, which was exciting for us because we did all the packaging. And they were having a big dinner with True here, which is somebody that I really admire, Nick Nuns and his crew. So it was a really special moment for me to come out and like be there with our, you know, with our clients, our partners on that, and like celebrate with them like this long journey to completion in a way, and kind of kicking off a new phase for them. And then the other thing was the Guild Writer Awards.
Mm-hmm.
It was important to me with you taking the reins on that this year to just come see you do it and support that. And I was really excited.
What's my grade? Did I pass?
I've got some feedback.
And so just full disclosure too, for people who don't know, I'm the director of the guild. It was exciting for me running it for the first time this year. So we had a record number of entries. If I remember correctly, it was 221 across 11 categories.
How does that compare to last year?
It was about 40 more than last year. Yeah. And I've already had some discussions about potential new categories to add moving forward, too. And so, you know, one of the things that I liked about the competition, and now that I've helped to organize it, see it in a different light too, is that it's clear the diversity of what's going on in terms of coverage and the way that people are writing and thinking about beer too. And
it's shifting, the brewing industry evolves.
There's a very clear difference in the way that people are paying attention to it and thinking about things a bit more critically, both in, say, a narrative reported piece as well as something that may be, you know, opinion or criticism focused too. And so going through, I mean, both of you guys were there too and obviously familiar with the work from Good Beer Hunting and perhaps others. And one of the things that I heard from other people is, I really want to read that now. I'm disappointed that I missed it when it came out during the year, of which I know a couple of were Good Beer Hunting pieces too. And so it's about, I think, getting that kind of exposure has become a really big thing in terms of benefiting both the guild, but also kind of what's happening around.
But imagine it gives your judges a unique perspective on what's been happening in beer journalism, because it's impossible to keep up with it all when it comes out. But when you're seeing a curated, you know, a self-curated set of articles that are submitted by the people who are most proud of that thing and think it has a chance to win, You're essentially getting a very short amount of time looking at the spread of what's been written and what people are writing about, and I would imagine you're seeing different kinds of patterns than anybody else would because of that sort of that subset of articles.
Yeah, it's clear that there's a change both in where things are being written, but also in terms of what won awards at the festival is what good things are being written and where it's happening too. And then that's on top of the kind of the content that comes through and the way that people are writing about the industry. So, from my perspective as kind of, taking a step back and putting on that hat as someone who's helping to lead it, it's very exciting to kind of see that growth and change.
Yeah. Well, it makes me even more proud, I think, if that many more entries are coming in. I think last year, GBH writers took 3 home. So I think it was 3. This year we doubled that with 6. I want to give a shout out to Austin Ray, our editorial director, who's been shaping those.
Yeah.
Because I don't know how, I can't speak for any other magazines, but I know that at GBH we give our writers a lot of freedom, but then we also give them, I think, a lot of really valuable input along the way to make those things better. We help each other find sources. I mean, the Slack channel that we run where everybody's in one room, it's kind of like a newsroom.
Mm-hmm.
I know that's greatly benefited the pieces we've written this year. Just having perspectives from other folks on what's going on and who to talk to and why they're interesting has been really valuable. So, shout out to that whole crew. Whether you took one home under your name or not, you probably contributed to one of those pieces that that took an award today.
I just want to say, working with Austin, as someone who came into beer writing from an amateur level as a blogger, as you did, Brian, working with Austin changed the way I approach a story. Having an editor that not only is incredibly critical of what you submit, but does it in a way that is so enthusiastic that the next time you do a piece, you want to make sure you're ticking his boxes.
Mm-hmm.
And because he gets a buzz off that, and you can buzz off that too.
That's going to be a new channel in Slack, ticking Austin's boxes.
Yeah. that's good. That could be our new catchphrase.
You make an important point. Of all the people, of the 6 that took an award today, 2 were op-eds written for us, one by Jesse Friedman of Almanac and one by Chris Heron from Creature Comforts.
Mm-hmm.
And then Austin took one himself for his George's Race to the Bottom about the beer laws.
Yep.
Blake, who's a brewer, has never written for a magazine before in his life, wrote the Cool Ship Adventure.
Yeah, that was a cool piece. I like that a lot.
Braden Kearney from Belgium, who's been writing for magazines for a little while, took one home for History. And then that was the 6. And so it's and Matthew Sampson, of course, took first place for International with the Scratch Brewing piece. Again, a person who had never really written for a publication. He was a scientist at Argonne National Laboratory when he reached out, and he was like, if you guys ever need some help technical writing on brewing, he's like, I know a lot about beer and I'm a scientist, like I could probably help. And then 3 months later, he wrote the piece that just took first place for the first time ever. I've always been really excited by the people we've been able to find just through personal relationships and people who are clearly gravitating towards good beer hunting for one reason or another. It's always different for the person. For a lot of those people, it's their first time ever trying to write for an outlet. And I think because of people like Austin and the enthusiasm of the team, they quickly, very, very quickly transform into really good storytellers, despite their amateur status.
Yeah. Something you said to me when I first met you, which was actually in Denver in 2015, when I was here for GBF.
That was when we first met?
Yeah, when we first met. And I said, I'd just done a couple of pieces for GBH, and I said, and I was in context of your pieces, I said it was a challenge reaching your level of writing, and you're like, no, it's nothing to do with my level, it's GBH's level, and it's all of our level. And I see that in all of our writers, like there's almost a sense of one-upmanship,
there's some internal team competition there, for sure.
There is, it's competitive. Like, for example, I think Kyle is an incredible writer, and the last couple of pieces he's written, I'm like, bastard, I really want to. That's an amazing piece. Like his War Pigs piece had some, the way he got the sense of place in there. Enjoyed that so much, and to the point where I was like, well, I have to try and capture that sense of place when I'm describing something in one of my articles. And that's the way GBH works, and the way we have the Slack channel now, we're always communicating with each other. It adds to that dynamic. But yeah, it is.
Yeah, I mean, it's to your point, I've been writing the least of anybody.
Yes, you have, yeah. You need to raise your game.
So let me ask you this, Matthew, because to get to the point that you had mentioned, Michael, in terms of kind of the flexibility and having your eye on this idea of the story itself, whatever that may be, in the writing process. The way that sometimes it turns out in the long form writing that, we do is that means there's a lot of words involved, right? And so this past week, for example, I had a story that published on kind of the status of IPA and what that means business-wise.
I just read that this morning for the first time.
Oh, the what? You
just, what? I just read it this morning for the first time.
Oh, and how did you? Yeah,
excellent.
It was good, good.
It was riveting. I read like half the length it actually
okay,
was.
Okay, so that's the point. So the thing was 4,300 words,
yeah,
which is not an insignificant amount of reading that's taken to get to the very end. And, yeah. You know, I luckily it's a case where, again, to work with Austin and to have input helped to create a narrative that was a bit structurally pleasing. So luckily, you know, it might feel easier to read.
I went through chapters with character development. I mean, right. There was character development in a piece about analyzing the role of IPA in the market. I think that's what made that piece so spectacular in my mind was I feel like I learned a ton about where IPA is in the market and the trends and, you know, where it's doing well and where it's kind of maybe flatlining in certain ways, specific brands and how they're performing. Like, all of that was in there. It was a very Brian Roth fun, like the building blocks of a Brian Roth piece were in there in spades.
I'll take it.
But then there was this beautiful layer, which I've seen you do before as well, of like on top of that, like all the icing on that cake is all of this like actual real character development from people who have been thinking about this in the field. And you do a great job of reaching out for multiple voices to kind of triangulate around an idea. I do the opposite sometimes. I write almost too authoritarian where I'm just like, this is what I think. And I know it's generally true. I don't want to mess it up with all these voices from other people who I sometimes just like want to write straight through the thing. But I find myself enjoying the writing style of yours in that way where you bring all these other voices in that give it a whole, like all these like little layers in between that kind of build up to the point. You do a little bit more showing, not telling, I guess, in that way.
Thank you.
So, but that's what made it read so quickly and genuinely. And like, it was just really fun. And then we had GIFs.
Yeah, which always helps
animated
to break it up a little bit.
Yeah.
They were so absurd. I would be so far into that piece. I was like, this dude with sunglasses. This is ridiculous.
The deal with it, the animation, is probably the coup d'etat, I think, of artistry when it comes to what I've seen in my pieces, at least. So thank you. Yeah, and that was a really great team effort. But to look at it from the word perspective, so Matthew, too, for the work that you've done, and maybe to pile on a little bit more in terms of the collective and especially what Austin's allowed, how have you seen kind of that flexibility and having that kind of range benefit the way that you're doing your writing?
It's interesting for me because I am I'm a full-time freelance writer, writing almost solely about beer. Maybe a little bit of cider now, but mostly beer. And I write for a number of publications, and GBH is the hardest work by far. It's interesting because I started before Austin came on, and I just dealt with Michael. And Austin coming on changed that dynamic. It was like, why is there only one source in this piece? Michael always asked questions, but Austin just asked big questions. And and that's because he had time to do that, because that's what his dedicated role was. But coming to a GBH piece, it's, you know, everyone else, they say, oh, can you give me 2,000 words on this? And there's a brief. With Good Beer Hunting, it's like, get inside it, but just, you know, it's like an open universe. It's like, you can go as far as you want. If you use 4,500 words, that's an immense amount of copy. But GBH gives you the freedom to that. But if you sent Austin 4,500 words of terrible copy, he would go back saying, well, here's 2,000 words that I left in that's good. Working for GBH is challenging because I think you ask a lot of questions of yourself when you're writing a piece, because that's what we are. We're curious. And so you can be halfway through a piece and go, actually, I didn't ask this, and I'm not going to write anymore because I need to go back and find out about it before I put it in. Because, you know, if you don't, Austin will ask you, I've read this, can you go and ask them about this? and so that's GBH. It's labor intensive work.
I remember that happening with your Highland piece specifically. This may be one of the more distinct ones I remember weighing in on when, I can't remember her name now, the brewer.
Holly Stevenson.
Mm-hmm. And it was the conceit of the story was that Highland opened up open themselves up to the idea that this West Coast brewer could come in, reinvent their profiles and their recipes, push the brand a little bit, and like be kind of refreshed to the drinker, and that that was going to be their future. And my first question was, well, what do they do if she leaves? And you were like, huh. I was like, if they're going to build their future on the back of this woman who's coming and reinventing their recipes and bringing her idiosyncrasies into the brewing process here, that's setting them up into a very vulnerable position. I was curious, like, do they have like a long-term contract or do they have a contingency plan? Can somebody else brew those beers if she's gone? And we got a little bit of an answer in that piece. Mm-hmm. And then it was like 6 months later, she got hired away by Guinness.
And that's the thing, I think in both in the reporting and then what ended up in the story with her saying that, you know, she viewed it as she wanted to be someone who could provide a strong voice and presence within the Mid-Atlantic beer scene, of which technically she's still doing.
Yes, absolutely.
With Maryland's Guinness Brewery. But it was so, I spent time with her during the reporting process and then even after. Her and her wife, they had literally recently bought a house. And I think that the response was very honest.
Yeah.
It's an entirely different situation when you've got Diageo and Guinness knocking on your door saying, hey, we want to make you the head brewer at this flagship brewery for an international brand, in which she actually got to go back and work with, I forget his name, the master brewer there is also from Stone.
That's right. Formerly.
Yeah. And so it was a case where I imagine there were all sorts of things, and both her and her wife had lived in DC before. But it's that kind of thing where it's not something you think about in the moment, because at least I know from my reporting, my mind is very much on that topic of, okay, so in that story, it's Highland and how it's changing and its place within North Carolina beer, because it's the grandfather of North Carolina beer. And you kind of miss these little things on the outside. You know, you got your blinders on to whatever degree, and it's kind of on the periphery. Well, and you know, that made that section better, having that little bit of context.
Well, that became the tension for me. I guess that was the wait a minute moment. this is a great story, and I'm happy to know like how Highland has transformed and where they're going. And like, this is a very interesting story if you care about Highland, or if you care about, you know, middle-aged breweries trying to reinvent themselves, like all those were still there. But for me, I guess I'm just too skeptical, but I'm always looking for like, well, what's the implied tension here? Cause like something could change, or what about this? And like, if I don't feel like the interview subject, or the subject we're writing about has necessarily considered that themselves, that's when I feel like the podcast gets interesting. That's when the articles get interesting for me, because those become moments where they're not just answering something they already know. They're not just telling you what's already in their heads. They're considering and trying to work through it in their answers to us. And that sometimes comes out in the story. And when it does, that's when it becomes really human for me. Those tension moments is there, you know, there's a certain amount of awareness, but then when they're asked to self-reflect on something uncomfortable or unanticipated, it becomes really interesting. Same thing just happened sitting down with the Sour Wild Ales Guild yesterday. We got all the way to the end of the conversation, and I was like, great, I'm going to ask a really explicit question. I have no idea how you're going to feel about it, but why are you doing this without the BA? And everybody just had this like look on the face, and the first answer I got was, huh, never occurred to us to consider doing this without the BA. And then the next answer was, yeah, I don't really have a connection with the BA at all. Like, we never would have thought that way. Like, we want to influence what they're doing, but I guess we don't want to, it would never occur to us to run it through them. And then here's why. And then I got this really interesting answer that highlighted kind of a little bit of a tension, maybe a healthy one, between, you know, this large organization that represents all of craft beer and this small organization that wants to do something niche and nimble and of their own volition. That to me was the whole story. Mm-hmm. Like, what they're doing as a guild going into the future will become interesting, but until they do that, it's still just an idea. But why they're doing it the way they're doing it is the interesting tension point.
So that sets up a wonderful segue, thankfully.
And great.
And looking at it, the implied tension of this moment that we're in Denver, Colorado, where, you know, the Great American Beer Festival acts as, for the public, the big party the Brewers Association gets to throw every year.
Yeah.
They've got the kind of internal one in the Craft Brewers Conference, which is for industry folks. But that I feel that there are lots of instances of that tension in storylines and things that are going on right now in the industry, and even right here in Denver during the event as well.
Yeah.
Are there things that you guys have seen or thought about leading into kind of like the Thursday, Friday, Saturday?
Well, there's a great question from the Fervent Few that I think hit that maybe asked a specific question to that. Yeah. This is from Swineheart. This is the guy that, whose logo is a pig holding a heart. he says, do you think GABF and the events surrounding it still hold the weight it used to in building hype for new and regional breweries? Is it a sign that states like Vermont don't even attend? Is that a sign that festivals have lost clout? One of the themes that I've seen over the last few years is that a lot of breweries are still coming to Denver to do things, but not necessarily pour at GABF. Mm-hmm. They're not necessarily seeing the value of being in front of, you know, 15,000 people they might never distribute to. But they do see value in coming to town and doing something interesting with other colleagues in their own small sort of contained way in terms of brand relevance or the marketing, you know, capabilities involved in that. Doing something on your own for a smaller group is seeming more impactful to them than standing at a table and pouring 1 ounce pours for 15,000 people who are drinking 100 samples that day. Mm-hmm. So it seems like there's a growing question as to whether or not it's worth the time and a substantial amount of money and investment in coming out to do those things.
It's interesting for me coming from a foreign market. If I owned a brewery, I would be chomping at the bit to have my beer there, whether or not I distributed to Colorado or not, because it puts you in front of such a massive amount of people. And it's almost coming, this is me coming from a foreign perspective, it's almost as if there is a group of breweries going against the BA for the sake of it, just to find a point of difference in the market. And that's fair enough. And it's their decision, but I feel that they're losing a massive opportunity. You know, it's, you look at things like that, like the Wicked Weed Festival, which people pulled out because of the AB InBev involvement. And I had some brewers from the UK that were invited, and they were sort of on the fence of wanting to go, but they pulled out because they needed to be seen as going with the flow and rallying against AB InBev. But that would have been a huge opportunity for them. And I feel like some brewers in the US, they do it out of almost a pride.
That's part of it for sure.
Yeah. Pride in terms of taking part in GABF.
Then a pride in like not being part of part of GABF because they're this long tail or the third wave, whatever you want to call it, and they're going their own way. And this is very much a huge thing. But coming from the UK, where we, you know, we don't have an organization like the BA. And I very often wish we do. We don't have access to the same level of statistics. There's not the same sense of camaraderie amongst independent brewers, although there is amongst a small group of them, but just not the market at large. And I would be breaking the door down to have my beer on there if I had the opportunity. And it's weird because at the Great British Beer Festival, we let American brewers pour their beer. And it all comes through the Brewers Association. But you don't get that. You don't get the Brewers Association. This is a whole other tangent completely. But you don't get the Brewers Association after putting all this effort to bringing American beer to the UK market. You don't get Ciba in the UK saying, okay, well, we've done this for you, so can we put some UK beer on it at GABF because it's all American beer. Mm-hmm. So it's fascinating for me. It's very different to what I experienced back home.
I don't know if that's a psychological position as much as it is the growth curve. Mm. And maybe where the UK is at versus the US. Because if you're a small brewery in Vermont, like a Treehouse, and you've got lines
like small?
A half a mile.
Are they still small?
Ish. 20, I mean, BA defined standards, that is quite small.
Yeah. UK small and US small are not the same thing. So.
Sure. But I mean, if you have a line that stretches beyond your parking lot every day when you're selling cans. The relevance of the exposure you would get at something like GABF, which to some of those brewers perhaps looks like a bit of the old guard, the old way of thinking or the old way of doing things. And it's not really evolving fast enough to capture what's happening in the business models or the consumer interests or the processes and styles that those breweries are making. I mean, there's not even a New England style IPA category to compete in.
Yeah.
So if we're talking about relevance, I'm probably going to stay at home if I'm one of those brewers and continue to build my relevance there. I think there's a little bit of a tectonic kind of shift in terms of the future, like who's going to define the future of craft beer. Is it going to be the Brewers Association, which has been around for a while now in craft beer years, or is it going to be a group of small brewers that are doing their own things regionally now? Like, do they need the central consolidated power of something like a Denver-based GABF, or do they have enough power in the Northeast now?
So I would say that it's maybe less in that case about the definition of the words craft beer so much as about the definition of the experience. And part of that is twofold. To put it in context of this, and this is something that I know we touched on in an op-ed that I wrote for Good Beer Hunting about kind of beer festivals. It was written after ticket sales for GABF. It took the longest in about 10 years. It was still sold out in a day, but...
Ticket sales for FOBAB, I think, are maybe not sold out still.
Mm-hmm.
It's alarming.
And so, you know, part of the context of that piece that ran on Good Beer Hunting was that the pushback, whatever that means in terms of how people are thinking about it, whether you're a drinker or a brewery, is now it exists in this world where there are these small community-based, regionally-based festivals where it's much more intimate, both in the number of breweries, the number of people, and most importantly, the interactions that occur there. And I put that in context, too, with the shifting way that both breweries and drinkers are thinking about something like visiting a business. So we know that, you know, what happens on location in the own premise at the tap rooms is growing very quickly, and people see that as a stronger and viable outlet. But the flip side of that, and this is also in a story that I had reported for Good Beer Hunting, was that brewers see it as this is a direct connection. Sure, the margins are great, but they also see it as an educational experience.
Absolutely.
And so there are these things in both translating it from what's happening in the day-to-day business and seeing how that can benefit them alongside these standard practices, which maybe aren't so standard anymore as the business continues to evolve and change in the ways that, you know, selling beer is happening, the way people are thinking about interacting with beer.
Yeah, it's a simple, I mean, if you were to ask somebody who's, you know, in their like young to mid 20s now, what is a craft brewery? The picture they would paint is fundamentally different than what any of us would have painted 10 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
We would have described a small factory that makes beer that distributes to the store near me.
A microbrewery.
Yeah. None of us would have described this sort of zeitgeisty waiting line for 4-pack of cans for dock sales and direct distribution. And I only drink at breweries now. I don't even go to bars. Like these new possibilities of existing just weren't conceivable just a few years ago.
Yeah.
So the idea that the idea that coming to GABF represents an opportunity for you, I think it's highly questionable if you're one of those breweries.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's somebody everybody has to look at in terms of time, money, and relevance. It's going to be different for everybody. There's certainly plenty of people that are trying to get in here. They had more breweries wanting to get in than they had slots for, but it wasn't an enormous amount.
There was some reinforcement, and I think of something I saw that maybe you put on Twitter, Matthew. Mm-hmm. I think it was Weldworks.
It's funny because I was literally just about to bring up the point.
Yeah.
So Weldworks are a great little brewery up in Greeley. So they're east of Loveland, Fort Collins in Colorado, and they're making absolutely amazing New England IPAs. And they had crazy long lines, and no one really knows about them, but they're blowing up, and they're having... The GABF is having an impact for them. Maybe it's because they're a Colorado brewery, though. You know, that could be the point of difference.
I have been told a few times that it seems like there are more Colorado breweries pouring to GABF than ever before in terms of overall percentage.
It's the BA homeland, isn't it? They're based in Boulder.
I guess that's what I'm describing. Is like the question was originally like, does it seem meaningful that there are no Vermont breweries there? It's like, well, yeah, it's increasingly becoming perhaps a regional festival, even though it has international import. To come here, pour your beer, and to go through that time and expense is much more relevant to somebody in this region because you're going to get bang for your buck.
Yeah. And part of that is you're looking at it just from terms of the volume, the number of breweries, right, to choose from based on where they're coming from to get to GABF. And there was an infographic, I think it might have been Bart Watson, of where it originated on Twitter, showing the percentage of breweries from each state who are pouring at GABF. Mm. And if my memory serves, that I think it was that West Coast kind of, it was more geographically focused in terms of who was here. And part of that is something I know that I've heard from brewers You guys probably have too, which gets back to this sheer financial stipulation that if, okay, so if you want to come, you're shipping your kegs, you're shipping your people, and then anything else that might happen in terms of the cost of staying here for a few days and food and all of that.
And then just the little amount of time you have to spare. I mean, with as many festivals are happening right now, some of which might have more relevance for you, even if it's not the amount of people in your hometown, your home city, your home state. I mean, everybody's trying to find ways to say no these days. Mm-hmm. They're looking for a reason to say no because there's just too many options. Mm-hmm. Going back to your piece of like festival fatigue, brewers have been saying no to festivals long before consumers started saying no to festivals. Mm-hmm. Because there's not enough bodies to go around and to gain relevance from it and to measure the value of it is really difficult. So you kind of just go to the ones where you just have like obvious value. And a lot of those have personal value between the brewers who are attending. That's who they're going to hang out with. Mm-hmm. And then whatever they get from a consumer base, from a marketing perspective, is maybe almost bonus to that.
There does seem to be, in very small anecdotal levels, a place like Weldworks, who's got a long line, which is great. You've got kind of the standbys. People are always lining up for Russian River and Lost Abbey. Funky Buddha, so we're recording this on Friday. Thursday, there was a line at Funky Buddha that was no less than, I would say, 30 people every time I passed by.
And they got picked up by Constellation, didn't they? So that's interesting. Because I do also see... You know, there's a lot of festivals, and you've talked about it very eloquently in your article, but GABF reaches a very mainstream customer. Mm-hmm. And I think, they're less concerned with ownership. I mean, you have like Coors and Miller and Bud pouring beer there. You know, it's a festival for everyone. And I feel that a lot of these smaller breweries, that relevance, they're finding it in the specialist market. At some point, they are going to have to go, hey, we need like, the mainstream market to pay attention, but it depends whether you want to go into that mainstream or try and grow the niche, which is that's hard work. So I don't know the answer to that.
Well, the difficulty of the mainstream in this context at the festival is you're a 5-foot by 2-foot booth surrounded by hundreds. And, you know, so last night, the main entrance where people come in is right by the Pacific area. Things are done geographically on the festival floor. And the area where it's Mid-Atlantic and Great Lakes was noticeably fewer people throughout the evening. One, because you come in and, you know, there's tables right there. Let's go get a drink. But at least anecdotally, that's also, if you're thinking about beer a lot, those are where some of the exciting breweries are too. And so, you know, if you're coming from Pennsylvania, I was actually, one of the things I was excited about was going over to the Mid-Atlantic area, of which Pennsylvania and New York State are included. sure. And so, because I think that the kind of beer being made there and the kind of consumer that exists in that market is very different from what, you know, I experience in North Carolina, where things have grown, versus, you know, Illinois, versus even the way that things have changed in the UK.
Yeah.
And so I feel if I find a brewery that's coming from Pennsylvania, for example, who's, for lack of a better term, their drinkers maybe aren't as progressive as other places. If they're making really killer beer, I find that's really exciting to locate that brewery, because in the grand scheme of things, you know, they don't have to go too far out. I actually just wrote a piece for Good Beer Hunting, which will be running later this fall, about my home region in upstate New York in the Finger Lakes, where there's this very strange dichotomy, because beer is finally a thing in the middle of wine country, but people are still figuring out what beer is beyond Jenny Cream Ale. And so you don't have to push the envelope there.
It's really interesting, because I just spent a weekend in Walla Walla, Washington, doing the wine tours and visiting a few vineyards, but there's a few breweries there, and they were, some of them were not making great beer, and the ones that were the range was very old school, because they were selling beer to a wine market, so they were still doing the classic brewpub menu of a lager, a Kolsch, a red, a porter, an IPA, but a couple of them were making really good beer, but they were reaching a whole new market that were used to drinking, you know, Syrah and Pinot Noir.
It's always a catch-22 scenario of, like, do you make beers to fit where your audience is, or do you move the goalposts so far away that you get attention for making beer that nobody ever thought would even be classified as beer? Mm. I've seen it happen both ways. You could certainly do a nice little business making, you know, something cream ale-like if you're trying to convert somebody over to craft beer, which you may think is inherently better than that just because of what it is, but Or you try and improve upon that product in some way and convert them over into lagers or pilsners or other sort of easy to kind of grok sort of beers. But then somebody comes along and they start doing farmhouse ales and saisons, and all of a sudden everybody's like, what the hell is this? It's so different that it stands out almost in its own category now. And, you know, those small towns will flock to breweries like that because it's, they're surprising everybody with what they're actually making and offering and what that experience is like. And I've seen that happen to towns. I've seen that happen in, on an individual level as well. We always talk about gateway beers. I've had just as much success giving somebody a, you know, a craft pilsner as I have giving them, you know, a wild or sour beer, because sometimes jumping all the way to the end of the line for them is what it takes for them to realize, like, oh, there's something here. This is worth exploring. I'm interested now. Versus I just have a slightly more expensive, slightly tastier version of what I already like in my hand. It's, you know, everybody's got a different reason for what their hook becomes. And I think that can happen at the macro level, too, with an entire town.
Mm-hmm. And even still wandering out around yesterday, it seemed clear, and maybe this gets to the point about kind of the average consumer, the beers that people seem to be very excited for had, it was different ingredients or just something that I would have noticed. There was a brewery, I think it was Old Town Brewery from Portland. They had a mushroom beer, which was, it was just an alt beer that they dry mushroomed, I guess is the best way to describe it. Dry shroomed it.
Yeah.
But in something like Funky Buddha, for example, like they're very well known for their adjunct beers. And it's presenting a very specific flavor in easy to understand context. And it does kind of open up things a little bit. And I found that one of the conversations that I've been having the last few days, between as I spend time between here in Denver, Seattle, and Portland, and based around New England IPA, is that, you know, the flavor profile, you know, beer geeks love it because it's new and it offers them a new experience that they haven't had before. But it's also a case where for someone who says, I don't like IPAs because they're too bitter, that's the gateway beer that completely changes their mind.
As nerdy as a hazy IPA can be, it's a gateway for a lot of folks.
Yeah.
I've seen that happening quite a bit in Chicago.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've seen it happening in the UK as well with guys like Beavertown, Cloudwater, Northern Monk.
They're shockingly approachable for as esoteric as they seem to, to craft beer fans.
Yeah. And they come in really cool cans.
They tend to do that.
Yeah.
How about that?
That was a bit of.
Nick Nunn's at dinner last night showed me a picture that NASA had released of I think it was the Voyager satellite. How do you describe it?
Yes.
I feel like it had a
the space probe.
There you go.
Yeah.
I was like, it's more than a satellite. It was a picture of that against like the stars of space. It was like the silhouette of this thing, and underneath it just said something like "Discover" and like NASA. And he's like, "Look, it's a New England IPA can," and it looked exactly. I mean, you could have wrapped that around a 16-ounce can and sold the shit out of it.
I think that's literally what the Veil and Cloudwater's latest collab, Chubbles, was literally that image. But I have to say, I was being a little bit facetious, tongue in cheek, with my previous comment about cans. But people do like them.
Are there other things that you guys are seeing or thinking about right now as you're around kind of all of the beer people that's kind of picking your interest?
Well, I'm on vacation.
Fair.
And so, which has been great because I've managed to turn my brain off because I'm always trying to think critically about beer. So I spent a day in Seattle just wandering around, Pike Place Market, got the commuter ferry over the Sound just to see that. And then I rocked up at a couple of breweries and I went to Holy Mountain as a customer. I didn't tell them I was coming and I didn't ask to see the brewery, which I'd normally do if I was in town. And it was a can release day just by complete coincidence. And I got there just as they'd started before the line started forming. So I was like, oh, I'm gonna get to the front of the line. And I got there. It was a New England style IPA with fresh hops, collaboration with Cloudburst. And people were like, clamoring for it, and I said, I'll just have one 4-pack, and they're like, are you sure you can have more, your allocation is more per person? I'm like, yeah, I'm just visiting, I just thought like, this is a complete coincidence. And they were like, oh, sure. And then the person next to me in line said, did I hear you're going to Colorado? You could sell that 4-pack for $50 if you're going to GABF to someone on the street. And I'm like, yes, I have no desire to do that. And now I'm thinking, maybe I should have done that. but it was just fascinating. I say I'm on vacation. It's impossible to switch off, really. But so I picked up that. And then I did some wine stuff. I went into the to some wineries. I went to like see some grapes being pressed and things like that. And when I do get back from vacation, I shall try and write some of it up for Austin, do a few B-rolls.
Well, I think you owe us a piece on Garage Project's wine.
I'm going to talk to Garage Project about their natural winemaking, which is very interesting. Beavertown, actually, speaking of natural winemaking, because the Garage Project, that came from getting these egg amphora.
Big kind of clay containers, yeah.
And they were putting beer in it, and it was just oxidizing, and it just wasn't any good. So they thought, oh, we'll put some wine in there. And Beavertown have just, I saw from their Instagram feed, they've received two amphora. But also, I also know that the brewer that runs that their pilot project has been at wineries. So I'm like, okay, they're going to get some great must, and they're going to do some must infused beers. That's got to be the plan. So that's exciting. I'm just having my sort of annual bit of leave in Fort Collins. But even I visit Fort Collins twice a year, and even now there's like three new breweries. But I'm hopefully going to see Purpose Brewing and Cellars on Sunday. And
yeah, because you need to get a picture of PH1.
That's I'm literally going to walk in
the
there.
The story we told about how Slack has transformed the way that we are writing stories as a collective, this is a prime example of how that is not bullshit. Because somebody mentioned in Slack to kick it off that PH1 had now arrived.
Yeah, that was me.
That was you, at Purpose Brewing. Our British writer in Fort Collins is saying, hey, I just heard the PH1 barrel that has lived this like this amazing life that we'll get to in the story is now at Purpose Brewing with Peter Bukhart. And somebody confirmed, and then somebody said, somebody volunteered, I said, write it.
And I said, no, I'm on vacation.
And Mike Sardina said, I'll write it, because he knows the inside story of that quite well.
Yeah.
And so he wrote a really great draft, and then we got him in touch with Peter Bukhart. Dave had his number, and so he got in touch with him. So we're going to get some more quotes out of that. And then you're going back to Fort Collins to take a photo of it so that it can be published as a cohesive and that, piece.
To give context, just to make sure, because I'm thinking of, is this the barrel that started at New Belgium that spent time at Rare Barrel
It's the Rare Barrel.
Yeah, right.
It's Russian River.
Yes.
It's the Rare Barrel.
But I literally just went to New Belgium for a beer after a 10-mile bike ride, and I bumped into someone I know that works there, and I said, oh yeah, I'm going to check out Purpose maybe today, maybe tomorrow, sometime of the weekend. He's like, oh, they just got PH1, and I'm like, the first thing I did was get my phone out of my pocket, and I'm on Slack, and I'm like, guess what, you guys?
But that's transformative.
Yeah.
That's how stuff happens.
So just to be clear, how does one take sexy portrait shots of a barrel?
I mean, how do you not?
The barrels are probably the easiest thing to take sexy portrait shots of. Yeah. And then you ramp up
the contrast. You just get a little shadow.
All that grain comes out.
Clarity, shadow. It's amazing.
And
the sculpture.
Photos in Colorado always look better because the light's so good up here.
It's at a different angle, that's for sure.
Yeah.
Blows out the sky and everything I take photos of.
Yeah, does that.
Tomorrow we're dropping a piece that Austin's hard at work editing right now. Coming to GBF is always, and CBC sometimes, is always a good chance for me to kind of take a step back and look at the larger trajectory of what's happening in the conversation in craft beer right now. Where I feel like there may be some existential angst, or there might be an opportunity to like see the light in a different way. And sometimes it's very self-reflective. But I wrote a piece called Brewers Dissociation that'll go out tomorrow morning. That is basically trying to make a case that, now that we've gotten to 12% market share with craft, which is sizable, but still small. It's an important niche now, but it's still a niche, I guess, is one way to say it. I feel like the conversation now is about slicing up that 12% and who's in, who's out, who's got, who's legitimate and who's not, rather than looking for ways to broaden that 12% into something bigger. Maybe it's gaining more market share. Maybe it's just about getting people more excited about that 12%. Because the Brewers Association's stated goal is advocacy for craft beer, which is a great goal for a trade group that represents those brewers. But I'm concerned that the conversation they're having with the consumer is sharing way too much sort of insidery divisiveness rather than getting consumers excited about craft beer right now. And I think the definition is getting too complicated. There's too many asterisks in lists. There's too many caveats, too many percentage points. And I'm afraid that that's going to turn off a consumer base who just wants to, they want to think of themselves as a craft beer drinker. And if you're telling them that what's in their hand all the time is not actually craft, then you're just going to start pissing people off and they're going to get annoyed and just tune out. And I think that's how the death of something happens. as people just start to grow apathetic to whatever your mission is because you're telling them they're just doing it wrong all the time. They can't do it right. And that's what I'm concerned about.
Yeah.
So that's the piece that drops tomorrow. Kind of looking at 2017 as a series of decisions and statements and behaviors that I think adds to that dissociation rather than association.
So yeah. Little did we know that showing up in Denver, I guess, was going to be the beginning of the funeral, as it were, or hospice care. Or...
No. I ended by saying, grow this fucking thing.
Okay, okay. Just to be clear, it's not necessarily the beginning of the death, but it's that precipice, I guess, where things need to go one way or the other. It is that
proverbial I would like to see the attention turned away from who's in and who's out. Mm-hmm. And towards what can be effectively done, especially at the state legislation level and the federal legislation level, which is where I feel like a trade group should be ideally focused. And they can be extremely impactful there. They have been in many ways. I think right now too much money is being invested in things like the Indy Seal and deciding, you know, trying to get the definition out there to more people, because I don't think that turns people into excited beer consumers.
Mm-hmm.
I think it turns them into people who think beer is complicated and annoying and there's a bunch of infighting and I don't want to be a part of that. I'm going to drink Beaujolais. I'm going to drink bourbon. I'm going to drink Coors Banquet. Forget this. This party sucks. That's what I'm worried about happening. This party sucks. Mm-hmm. I don't want that notion to happen.
If I could do a plug for a party that doesn't suck, that is not about who's in and who's out, to the fervent few,
there you go.
Because as the awards were being announced today from the Guild of Beer Writers, you know, one of the things that I always think about in terms of what I write and how it's shared is that I really hope that it impacts people. And I know that we've always been very open about the appreciation for the support, but in case of kind of like the success that we see as a collective group, and kind of how that quite literally is buoyed by
the directly tied
to, yeah. Which is a great reason that people might come to interact with us, as Swinehart did, and is a good excuse to help be a part of that now award-winning for very successfully a couple years in a row.
I've literally just come from having a beer with a fervent few member who's visiting GABF from the UK.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a good friend of mine, Phil and Steph, who run the Caps and Taps bottle shop in North London. But yeah, they're huge GBH fans, but it's just great to see, you know, that community coming together.
I mean, if I could put the numbers in context for people who are part of the fervent few, I think we just broke our second tier goal, which was $2,500 a month. 2 years ago, that was the entire editorial budget.
Mm. Yeah.
Because a couple of years ago, I was still doing...
So are you doing those handwritten thank you cards yet?
But yeah, just to give people a sense of where we're at, that it is now, I think, and now that is about 25% of our direct like editorial expense for, you know, photographers, writers, roughly speaking. That doesn't account for people's salaries and whatnot, but just like how many stories we publish and the monetary value of those stories for what we pay out. They're covering the direct expenses of about 25% of that now. Mm-hmm. That's substantial.
Yeah,
we never expected that to occur. I thought it'd just be like a small little club of people that were super fans that saw the value in what we were doing and just wanted to throw us a few dollars every month. Mm-hmm. For it to have blossomed into reaching a second tier goal, which I sort of had to invent to keep it going.
Yeah.
It's amazing. And so we're really appreciative of that. It's directly resulting in the content that took home 6 awards today.
Mm-hmm.
From a variety of people around the world. We had a winner from Belgium, Georgia, 2 from Georgia, 1 from California. I'm going to forget them now, but all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
And that's only made possible by those. So thank you.
Yeah. Might be a good time to go explore what the city has to offer.
Yeah.
Put on our black and maybe or not attend a funeral. I'm not entirely sure.
Well, we're going to truth. You can put on black and attend
that's
a funeral.
Yes.
No matter what.
All right. Then I'm all set. Really nailed that one. All right, cool. Well, thanks to the firm view and thanks you guys. Good to sit down and chat for a while.
Thank you, Brian.
Thanks for listening this week. If you head over to the Good Beer Hunting website, you'll find a collection of new news and insight from around the beer industry. From Dave Eisenberg's latest Sightlines pieces on leadership changes at Stone, breweries buying other breweries, and the latest on Goose Island's BCBS series, as well as our latest op-ed from industry professionals. This time, it's Victory Brewing founder Bill Kovaleski, who writes about the importance of investing in your home territory. Thanks again for our Fervent Few community for making this episode possible. If you want to join the fun and become part of the GBH community, check out patreon.com/goodbeerhunting. That's it for this week. Our music is produced by Andrew Thibodeau, and our sound engineer is Jordan Stalling of Particle Audio. Aim true, poor liberal folks. Have a great week.